Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to David Koenig, who has written what has to be one of the most perfect books for writers on film. It's called Shooting Columbo, The Lives and Deaths of TV's Rumpled Detective. It's a must for any fans of Columbo, of Peter Falk's iconic detective, and we had a very good conversation about it. If you enjoyed the episode, please remember to like, subscribe, and do all the things you can to spread the word. I really appreciate it if you do that. If you want, you can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty. But before you do any of that, please just enjoy the conversation. Your first sort of connection to Columbo, when you know did you watch it as a kid, or what was your—
I was a very small boy when it first started in the early 70s, but it became my mom's favorite TV show. So even though I was a small boy and it was kind of over my head, there was only one television set in the house back then, and every fourth Sunday it was on Columbo. The other three nights of the week she would watch Streets of San Francisco. Was another favorite show. Typically Columbo started Sunday nights right after The Wonderful World of Disney. So the whole family would watch The Wonderful World of Disney. Then most of the kids would go to bed and my parents would watch Columbo, and I would stick around and I was intrigued. And it was, even though I didn't understand everything that was happening, it was just that character was so interesting to me, and it took me a couple of years before I finally sort of got the show and understood it, but watched it my whole life, and it became one of my favorite television shows. So unique.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember what I think I've got a similar relationship to it, because I remember watching it as a kid in that, you know, pre-streaming way that you've just described, you know, the whole family sitting down to watch, you know, the Rockford Files or Dukes of Hazzard. Sure. or whatever it was. But then as a sort of watching it, I think I went back to it as like a student, you know, it was like one of those things that would be on in the afternoon, and being a student, you know, right, you would be available in the afternoon to sit and watch it, and becoming much sort of more intrigued in a way that I never felt any urge to rewatch The Fall Guy or any of those other TV shows.
Right, absolutely. Well, I think it's a part that the show was so unique and well done. Always one of the reasons Peter Falk, who hated television, was obsessed with becoming a movie star. One of his reasons he did it was that because he was promised that there would always be a feature film talent and budgets available. And that became a big point of contention as years went on, as they tried to squeeze the budget and he didn't like it. But also probably the biggest reason is the uniqueness and the lovability of his character and how much of himself he poured into that. And so people of all ages from all countries could sort of latch on to this curious fellow.
I mean, that is the thing, isn't it? It's that, you know, he's such an unlikely sort of hero. And yet at the same time, that's what makes him. And I love the bit in your book where you're talking about how the character develops. Maybe you could explain that a little bit to listeners who might not have had an opportunity to read your book yet, but that process of sort of finding Columbo.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is so interesting because it started out, Columbo originated from a play called in the early 60s called Prescription Murder, by Levinson and Link, these two fellas who would become extremely, probably the best known mystery writers in television. And they wrote this play with a minor character of the detective who doesn't show up until it's halfway over. And he's just sort of this odd, curious fellow. He's originally conceived was supposed to be a very large, stocky, imposing guy, your typical detective, and he mistakes him as a sort of a dumb oaf. He's this just big detective, bumbling guy, and I'm the really smart killer, and I can trick him and move him around. But the detective is so persistent. Eventually, he breaks him down and cracks the case. And so when Peter Falk was cast in the pilot, Prescription Murder, he sort of stuck fairly close to that sort of plain, calm character. He was a smaller, we'll say cuddlier version, but still it was fairly close to as written. But when he agreed to do it as a regular series, he knew that had to become a much more engaging character, someone that was a little quirkier, that people would have interest in coming back week after week after week to watch. And his idea was to make Columbo Peter Falk, and all his idiosyncrasies he had in real life and all the reasons people loved him and that he drove people crazy, he show by show, episode by episode, would build those into the character of Columbo, so that by the end of season one, you are basically watching Peter Falk, the detective, you know, go toe to toe with these very clever murderers.
And the structure that was right from the beginning. That was in the play, right? The structure of having the murder sort of play out in front of you at the very top of the play in this case, but in the TV show later on.
Exactly. They called it an inverted mystery, which was not unheard of, but fairly rare in literature, not the conventional way you want to kick off a story, in which you would see the plotting and then execution of this perfect crime. And then the audience would think, oh my gosh, he's got to get away with this. He's made no mistakes. And then one by one, the detective would come in halfway through and find little teeny little inconsistencies in their story, or, you know, little clues lying around that the audience didn't see. And you'd go, son of a gun, how did I not notice that? And pretty soon, you know, he would just have enough where he would hang the guy.
Yeah. And it reminds me, I was just reading a book yesterday and it said, if you want to make God laugh, make plans. And that seems to be the structure of a Columbo episode, you know, the perfect murder.
Exactly so.
Yeah, some tiny little thing goes wrong and that becomes a noose. You were saying that so that Peter Falk basically absorbed his own personality and Columbo sort of, you know, meld into one in a way. But at the same time, there was sort of very, you know, I love it. It's almost like watching the scene in Richard Attenborough's Chaplin, where he goes into the sort of wardrobe
prop department and just picks out a bowler hat and a cane and big shoes. And there you go. He's got his character. And Peter Falk sort of does the same. You describe him walking around and picking out suits and raincoats and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. That original wardrobe was Peter Falk's own wardrobe. They'd originally wanted the character to wear like a big overcoat, you know, like an opposing detective of the 60s might. And he pulled an old beat up raincoat out of his own closet. And that became his signature costume. The gray suit underneath, the drab pants. There's this drab green tie with little white spots that he wears in most of the first 40 some episodes. The shoes were his own. He figured, if I'm doing this all the time, I'm going to be comfortable. And brown leather shoes that he had for years that were falling apart before the series even started. That became part of his outfit. And in fact, he loved those shoes so much that even after they literally fell apart, there's one episode in the fourth season in which he's supposed to jump out of or fall out of a tree. And a stuntman did it, but he wanted to wear Peter Falk shoes. And in falling out of the tree, he broke his ankle, and Peter Falk's shoe had to be cut off his foot. And Peter Falk insisted on sewing those shoes back together so that hopefully he could use them again, because that was the signature costume of Columbo.
And there were all these other little things, like obviously there's the cigars. I'm always curious about the cigars because they look green. What are those cigars?
I don't know what type, but they were typically really cheap cigars. He does make reference in several episodes about what lousy quality his own are, but he loves them. And a couple opportunities he has later in the series in which he's offered fine cigars by the stately murderers. And it's a huge trait for him because he's used to, you know, these old stogies. But everything about Columbo was supposed to be dingy and unassuming, and the opposite, the mirror image of these clever murderers. And they would mistake him as thinking he was the opposite in every way. You know, they're clean and neat and rich, and he's this poor, dingy slob. And they would assume, I'm brilliant, so he must be dumb. But that was the one thing they both shared, was, in fact, he was even smarter than them.
I mean, watching them sort of back to back, as I have been doing sort of the last, well, over the summer, not necessarily binging them. I tend to watch one or two a week rather than. But I do notice that there are real complexities in his performance. And you point this out as well. I think it's the episode with Leonard Nimoy as the doctor, and that's a heart surgeon who uses the wrong type of thread as a web plot for killing a patient. And you point out that when he's sort of giving his final sort of summary of why the person is a murderer, he actually gets really angry. And it's very unusual to see Columbo sort of, usually it's kind of like he's almost apologetic. You know, he maintains that sort of calm of sort of like, oh, I'm really sorry about this, but I'm afraid we're going to have to arrest you, you know? But in this case, he actually sort of loses his rag a little bit.
Yeah, and that does not happen very often. It happens maybe three times in the run of the series. And maybe for that reason, it's so impactful, because it completely takes you by surprise. And why it typically happens is where Columbo realizes, okay, this guy knows I know he did it. I don't have to keep up the, oh, I'm so sorry. What was I thinking? Shtick, because time is of the essence. So he doesn't have time for that. And there's a moment near that end of the episode with Leonard Nimoy, the doctor, where he realizes, you know, if I don't catch this guy, he's going to kill again. And it's this kindly old man that's about to lose his life. So toward the end, he really loses his cool. And it's not a lot of that was on Peter Falk's decision to take the character momentarily angry, because it sort of hints at it at the script, but it doesn't say Columbo loses his cool. And Peter Falk just took that line and just slammed like a coffee pot or something on the desk. And and accuses the guy. It happened a couple seasons later in an episode with Robert Conrad, and would happen again many years later, but really powerful moments, because that's the last thing you expect is kindly old Columbo to lose his cool.
It's funny that you should say that he's, because that's one of the things that I'm watching it and I'm thinking about how his behavior and his sort of persona. I'm always trying to work out whether he's, it's sincere is the wrong word, but whether it's shtick, whether it's an act, whether, you know, whether deep down, you know, whether when he gets home and, you know, to his invisible wife, he sort of, you know, becomes totally different person and becomes very, you know what I mean? Because this is just a strategy for catching these people.
Well, yeah, and that's a big point of controversy with fans of the show is, when is Columbo lying? When is he telling the truth? Does he ever tell the truth? Is everything made up? And maybe he really has a British accent and he goes home to his beautiful wife and, you know, and 18 cats and, you know, in this mansion and, you know, he's really a millionaire. Yeah, who knows, you know, in real life, because that was the idea from the beginning, is we want Levinson and Link, as they devised the show, wanted the biggest mystery about Columbo to be Columbo himself. Mm. They wanted him to just sort of drift in, make all these odd statements, and, you know, then maybe they're true, maybe they're not. Does he even have a wife? That's a big argument as well, or not. And then sort of at the end of the story, just kind of disappear. You would never see his home. You'd never see him at the police station. You wouldn't find out too much about his real life, except for these sort of silly little stories that he'd use to throw the killer off kilter. But yeah, that we could have that long argument about, is there really a wife? Is there really a brother-in-law? I know there's a dog, but what, you know, beyond that, what's real and what's fake? It's, you know, it's all up for debate.
It's very open for debate. It reminds me, there is a Jim Thompson novel. I can't remember the name. I think it might be Population 1802. But anyway, there's a Jim Thompson novel, and there's a sheriff in it. It might be The Killer Inside Me. Anyway, there's a sheriff in it, and the sheriff is evil, and he covers up his sadism with, like, cliches. You know, well, you know what they say, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't. And he knows that he's basically needling people with this sort of, like, good old boy sort of, you know, persona. And when I watch Columbo, there's a little bit of me thinks, oh my gosh, I think he might be doing the same thing. You know, he might just be torturing these people.
Yeah, actually, that's a great point, because it's the same principle at play, in which when they first hear these silly questions and disarming statements, it's sort of a very low bar. It's to take them, put them at ease and make sure they feel as if they're not in any danger in any way. But after, there's always some point in the episode, and with a couple people it's early on, but usually it's about 2/3 of the way in, where they realize, doggone it, this guy's on it, and will you please shut up. And there's even one point in one of the latter episodes where he comes back for, just one more thing. And the guy throws him out of the house. He's like, no more things. One more thing. And he, you know, literally tosses him out of his house.
That's so funny, because that's always the way I'm thinking when I'm watching it. You put yourself, because you've seen the murderer, you're kind, yes, of like, you're much more involved in the murder than you usually would be in this sort of show. So it's not exactly empathy, but it's, you know, you feel it's that Hitchcock thing that Hitchcock does in Marnie, where you want the burglar to succeed, you don't want the police or the witness to discover the burglary taking place. So I'm always just thinking, just run away. Just stop trying to answer his questions. Just run, you know?
Yeah, because the murderer's always trying to help Columbo, because he figures he has no chance of figuring out my perfect crime. And he doesn't have the advantage that we have. And we know Columbo is really sharp, and he's just playing cat and mouse with him. So we can't tell him, you know, grab him by the lapels and say, stop helping him, close the door, you know, don't let him in, pretend like you're not home. If you see him, run away. But they think you know, oh, well, you know, he's just this harmless guy, and they help hang themselves.
Absolutely. And the thing about the series as well, and this is one thing that is hugely rewarding when you're rewatching it today, is just the quality of the co-stars, the quality of the people who are coming in and doing the, and the quality behind the camera, of course. You've got Steve Bochco, who went on to do Hill Street Blues, NYPD Blue. Did he do the Rockford Files, or was that David Milch? I think it was David Milch, maybe.
That was...
The Sopranos guy, wasn't it?
No, it was Stephen J. Cannell.
Oh, right. Okay.
Who also worked on Columbo. Everybody worked on Columbo.
Okay. Did it become sort of a university for TV, for people working in TV?
Well, it was more than that, because it was reserved for directors and producers who were very accomplished, who were willing to do it, but also for... like the cream of the crop, the wonder kind kids who, you know, the Steven Spielbergs and Boschkos and such, who they could tell were going to be really big things. Peter Fisher, everyone who went on to be huge after Columbo got their start there.
Yeah. And I mean, that the Steven Spielberg episode is, you know, it's brilliantly directed. It's just, it is a miniature film. It's not, it's got no, it could easily be released as a feature.
Yeah, which is interesting, because Peter Falk was initially against the idea. That was the second regular episode filmed. And he was like, wait, you told me we're going to get the best of the best, these accomplished cream of the crop directors and writers, and you're giving me this 24-year-old kid? You've got to be kidding me. And they're like, give him a chance. Watch this. He's done a couple of shows in other series. Take a look. And he's like, okay, but I guess it's not that big a deal. The director doesn't really matter that much anyway. And as he's watching Steven Spielberg work, he's just becoming so, so fascinated by all his tricks and clever things he did, and how he treated the actors and everything, that Peter Falk, from the beginning to the end of that episode, went from having very little respect for directors to, by the end of the show, he wanted to direct an episode of Columbo. And that became the biggest point of contention, and massive fights and drag down brawls through the end of that first season, is because, inspired by Steven Spielberg, Peter Falk wanted to direct an episode of the show, because Spielberg can do it. Boy, that looks fun. I want to give it a hand.
Yeah. But I mean, he's kind of not got the temperament perhaps for TV direction, because he's so kind of you talk about his work process and how indecisive he is and how sort of slow he is about coming to decisions and things like that.
Yeah, 100%. And he found that out when he finally, after three suspensions and many, many arguments and walkouts and sick outs, they finally let him direct an episode. And he discovered, I'm not really well suited for this. He did a pretty good job, but I mean, it just, everything about it went against how he liked to work, which, as you say, was very slow and deliberate and not sure, and had to do things over and over. Just one more take, just one more take, just one. If he was part of everything, he couldn't do that.
Just one more take being his, sort of just one more thing as a detective. It's sort of, it's right there. That's his behavior. I mean, it's also interesting, because you say earlier that he wanted to sort of be a big movie star, but when he comes on Columbo, he's not a particularly established star. I mean, it's Columbo that makes him, isn't it? Right.
Well, yes and no. Everybody knew who Peter Falk was. He was a very well-known film personality at that time. But he was known more as like a supporting character, like a character actor. You know, he'd always play a mobster or in comedies, like a second banana, like in the Great Race with Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis. So he was a very well-known film personality. Just, he wanted to be a movie star. He wanted to be the lead, ideally, romantic roles, or, you know, the hero. And Columbo was sort of the first opportunity for him to be the hero, but it was this unconventional, kookier character, and it was on television. Nowadays, you know, much of the best entertainment is on television. But back then, you know, in the 60s, when we saw the first of Columbo, it was, you know, Gilligan's Island and Green Acres, and that was television, or how people viewed it. You know, oh yeah, that's where you go to watch Batman and the Munsters. You know, if you're doing legitimate work, you're at the movie. So it just, people naturally look down on it. And in fact, Columbo would turn him into that movie star. At first, it cost him a couple roles. Like, he did a role on Broadway, The Prisoner of Second Avenue, Neil Simon, a play. And then when it came time to turn that into the movie, they were like, he's too well known for Columbo. And so he lost that role, and that caused more friction on the set of Columbo. But eventually he started getting those lead roles to where he did become the movie star that he always wanted to be. And unfortunately lost Columbo momentarily because of it.
Right. I mean, it's interesting that you're saying that about what television is like when Columbo arrives. And, you know, arguably it's totally different when it sort of peters out towards the end. How much of an effect did Columbo have in changing that, in changing television and the way it's being produced?
I don't know that people watched Columbo and said, oh, that we've got to start making high quality television because of Columbo. Columbo mm-hmm. was one of several shows that was different, that was seemed to be a lot more intentionality went into it. A striving for quality, especially urged on by Levinson, Link, and Peter Falk. They demand, they weren't going to waste their time with it if it wasn't, you know, this top produced show. So that there were programs like that, and again, Columbo not alone, increased the frequency of it. But you had the studios who were always fighting the opposite argument. They didn't care how good it was. They knew there's three channels. People are going to watch our show no matter how conventional it is. I won't say bad, because a lot of the old TV shows are good, but so many of them are similar in nature, very simplistic, a template that's repeated over and over and over again without the forethought that went into shows like Columbo and many shows we have today.
So going back to the co-stars who often appear playing the murderers, excuse me, although it's always it's interesting to see one of Peter Falk's friends, I think, and a guy who was in a few Stanley Kubrick films, who's in Paths of Glory and the Killing. And he's a guy who runs a chili restaurant that Columbo goes into. What's his name?
His name, he plays Bert, the guy at Chile. I'm drawing a blank. I know who you're talking about. Tall fellow. But he was, along with several other actors, were sort of from the John Cassavetes repertory company. And they would, Peter Falk learned this trick from John Cassavetes, and working with him shortly before he agreed to do Columbo the series, is that one of the great things about having your own show or producing your own movie or, you know, being the lead in a series is that you have more power to get things like your buddy's work. So in almost every episode of Columbo, you'll have a Bert, the chili vendor, or his stand-in Mike Lally, or his other stand-in Dick Lance, or John Finnegan, or all these folks who were personal friends. They were actors as well, but they were personal friends of Peter Falk. And that's, you know, these 8 or 10 guys, that's completely how they got the work, is that they knew Peter Falk. And that was, they always did a good job, and it helped keep Peter in a good mood that he was constantly got to work with his buddies.
Timothy Carey is the name.
Yes, Timothy Carey. Yes, exactly right. Yes, this big sort of almost Frankenstein-looking deadpan face, but a terrific actor who appeared in a couple of Columbos.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And then you have the sort of the as I was saying, the sort of the lead in a way, because I think the murderer is kind of probably on screen more than Columbo is, because usually you have a 10-15 minute prologue in which even Columbo enters. Who are your favorite of those actors who come in?
Well, the one who I think just epitomizes it, does the best, for me at least, is Jack Cassidy. I mean, he is just so, he was in Murder by the Book, the episode with Steven Spielberg, in which he plays the author who murders his book writing partner, who's had all the talent. But he just is this perfect opposite of Columbo. It's like black and white, and he's the white with his platinum hair and his nice teeth and his smooth, smarmy nature. He's so self-confident and so arrogant, and just all the qualities of Columbo. He is the opposite, the flip side. So he'd appear three times in three different episodes, and I love them all. He's just the perfect. And many of them, Leonard Nimoy was terrific. Donald Pleasance. One appearance in which he's the wine connoisseur, in which he was the first sort of sympathetic villain of Columbo, who didn't really want to kill his brother, but his brother was going to take away the one thing that he loved in life, which is winery, and his brother was so mean. So you sort of identify with him. And toward the end, Donald Pleasance is like, okay, take me away, but can we have a glass of wine first? And they become sort of friends at the end, which, you know, Columbo had never done before. And that inspired a whole rash of episodes with Johnny Cash and Mel Ferrer and others, where sort of Columbo befriends, you know, and reluctantly arrests them at the end.
Yeah, it kind of plays into, you know, he's such a curious character, in the sense that his curiosity is very much core of his personality. So that when he finds something that's really interesting that the murderer does, so loving wine, he sort of dives into it and becomes almost a bit of a wine bore, you know, with Donald Pleasance. And
absolutely, and it also helps in his solving the case, because the more he can find out about their area of expertise and what the mystery revolves around, the better chance he has of solving it.
I also love the fact that in Murder by the Book, the episode that you reference, you also point out in your book that the idea of an author killing his writing partner was a kind of amusing sort of twist on the two guys who have thought up Columbo in the first place.
Yeah, because they, even though Levinson and Link produced that episode and were in charge of it, that initial idea was not theirs. It was a friend of theirs, a famous film director named Larry Cohen, who sort of a cult film director. He was sort of bumming around the studio, and he was personal friends with them. And there was such a rush to get those initial story ideas made that they were just brainstorming ideas to do. You know, we've got to write six scripts in 4 months and have everything filmed and done. And what are we going to do? So they were pulling people in out of the hallways to see, you got any ideas for a Columbo? And so they pulled him in, and he's like, well, what about you guys? What if we did one about you? You know, where the one writer has all the talent. And he wants a break off from the writer who has no talent. And so the other guy doesn't like that and kills him. And they're like, oh my gosh, yeah, that's really good. And once that got around in the studio, the joke became, you know, well, which one is the one that has no talent who wants to kill the other guy? And that went on for weeks with them being teased about that.
You quote a great story of Larry Cohen, I think in London, walking around a park with like a portable recorder and recording just how you could kill somebody. Oh, you could kill somebody like this. You could kill somebody like that. And that becomes, you know, five or six episodes that he throws out.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what he did. And they paid him 1 year. They paid him six figures. He said, I don't have time to write anything, but I could think stuff up. And, you know, I'm headed to London on vacation for weeks on end. I can't write a Columbo, but I'll, you know, think up some ideas. And so they paid him six figures to just walk around for a couple hours here and there and just throwing ideas off the top of his head. And he submitted over 20 ideas for story ideas, several of which did become episodes of, well, what if it's a musical conductor? Well, what if it's a magician? Well, what if it's a, you know, that it, and what sort of natural plot could come out of that job description.
And so, I mean, when you're getting some of these character actors who are coming in, and you get John Cassavetes, for instance, coming in and as a conductor, and of course at the same time
Falk is probably has his most fruitful creative partnership in movies with Cassavetes. It's making his best, arguably his best films. Maybe Elaine May's Nicky and Mikey can certainly stand up. It always feels like the best Cassavetes film Cassavetes never made, you know, which is not to take anything away from Elaine May. I think it's a superb film. So he's kind of learning from Cassavetes and people like that as well, isn't he? He's not just, he's going away and having this film career, then he's coming back to Colombo and sort of thinking, how could I use some of those lessons with my character and with the direction of Colombo?
Absolutely, because that, I mean, he was always a naturally indecisive person, but working sort of that improvisational, almost sort of working environment that Cassavetes and Elaine May would work with greatly inspired Peter Falk, and also them encouraging him to put a lot of himself into the character. That all came from, you know, the idea for that came from his work with those two people. So that became his natural working environment. He chafed at that the very first time they worked together. But in time he grew to embrace it, and it slowed him down even slower to where that first season it took, they were supposed to finish each episode in 10 working days, 10 shooting days. And he was always pushing it to the end. And a couple of them went to 11, which was not good when you had no time to spare. I think one episode even went to 12 days. But by the sixth season, there was an episode that in fact, one of the reasons is that he invited Elaine May to help work on it. But that one stretched instead of its 10-day schedule. They spent 30 shooting days on that episode. So that, I mean, you can see things really got out of hand.
I mean, part of that was him as well. Not he didn't really learn the script until the last minute. And it's sort of, it's a weird combination having that improvisation and a murder plot, which has to be sort of by its very nature, has to be work like clockwork, really.
No, exactly right. And that was one of the big problems, was he would try to have that feeling as if we're winging it. But you're right, with a murder plot and exact clues that create this intricate puzzle, is you can't wing it with a puzzle. You can't shake up all the pieces and throw them on the table and expect for them to fit together in some satisfying manner. And that did become a problem as the years went on. Especially in that one episode I reference, in which if you watch it, you're like, well, why is that person doing that? And it's part of it is because they were sort of making it up as you go along, and that doesn't work in Colombo.
Right. And there's also the thing that, like, he, again, this is, I'm if I didn't keep referencing your book, it would sound like I'm the biggest Colombo expert ever, but I'm only an expert because I've read your book. But I found it fascinating as well. There was a moment where he sort of says, well, why does he even have to investigate murders? Why can't it just be the character? It doesn't, you know, we don't always have to have a murder necessarily.
That all started when he started working with Patrick McGoohan, who is this really powerful, terrific actor and director, but he liked to do things his own way. And he did not care for the program Columbo. He thought it was repetitive. He thought it was silly. He thought it was dull and uninteresting. But he really liked the character of Columbo. So he started getting Peter thinking about, well, why does it have to be a mystery? Why can't we have a Columbo comedy? Can't we have a Columbo horror movie? You know, we could put Columbo in a million different situations and he'd still be just as wonderful. Why does he always have to be in this Agatha Christie story? You know, that's sort of silly. So he kept getting Peter to try and think outside the box, which for me was a big mistake, because the more, and they ended up working together in about a half dozen different episodes. And especially later on, as Patrick McGoohan and Peter Falk started getting more personal control over the show, they could
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Build more of their preferences in, which was highlighting the quirks of Columbo at the expense of the mystery portion of the show. And for me, the character just works best within those confines. It was tailor-made to play off of different types, to be inquisitive for a reason, to, you know, be tenacious, you know, with the biggest payoff in these particular circumstances. And you lose so much of the effectiveness if you put him in a totally different type of story. Yeah, you've still got that amusing character, but you're not utilizing all his superpowers if he's not being able to play off them in the proper circumstances.
Yeah, it's even when I like the episode when he goes to London, but even that feels a little bit, you know, the fish out of water aspect of it. You sort of think, it still feels like, you know, somebody in the writer's room just throwing that out as an idea of let's shake things up, let's send him on holiday to Spain, you know, rather than, you know, there's a novelty aspect to it that isn't really organic, I don't think.
Yes. Well, that particular episode was the first big, was in the second season. That was the first big novelty episode. That was the whole purpose for it. For NBC and Universal Television was for the second season, we need something big. And, you know, in Happy Days, they had and Brady Bunch, they'd send the people to Hawaii. You know, that doesn't really work for Columbo. So Columbo, let's send them to the land of Sherlock Holmes. And that was, you know, it was a promotional stunt is why they had that. And I remember as a little kid visiting the Universal Studios tour theme park, and they had a massive display of, you know, watch this fall as Columbo goes to London. It was a huge promotion at the time.
Would that have anything to do as well with, you know, Columbo being popular outside of the US? I mean, I'm from England, so I watched it in England, and he was a very popular character in England. Was that also sort of a nod to his international appeal, perhaps?
Yeah, oh, absolutely as well. It was probably very, you know, this being in the planning stages, just after the first season, he hadn't really taken over the world quite to the extent that he would, but they could tell he was becoming extremely popular globally. And NBC was always encouraging them, whenever we can take him out of LA, the better. And two seasons later, they would take Columbo to Mexico. And two seasons after that, there were plans to take Columbo to Japan. And they actually, the writer and the producer actually flew out to Japan to scout out sites and try to fine tune what the story would be. And so if they had their druthers, they would have taken Peter Falk around the world, you know, solving mystery at every stop.
You talked about him getting popular, sort of not necessarily immediately after the first season, but it growing and growing with the. Well, what do you think accounts for that popularity? Because it's sort of looking back, you know, I see it and I'm really enjoying it. I'm enjoying rewatching it, but it is strange television. You know, it's strange to watch. It's a strange character. It's not Starsky and Hutch. It's not, you know. The Streets of San Francisco with Michael Douglas.
Yeah, and I think you just described the main reason why it is because it's strange and different and not you know, some American cliche of, you know, cop show. It's something unique, something different. And I'll always believe the greatest reason for its success was just the innate lovability of Peter Falk. I mean, just as he is on that show is how he was in real life. And even though he would drive all his friends and colleagues and wives crazy, you know, they, at the end of the day, they all just loved him because they knew he was a good person who was just trying to do his best. And he was real smart and real funny and just a blast to be around. But he'd drive them all a little crazy, and that's the show. And it's just, I think people mostly want to hang out with that guy, and the killing gives us an excuse to hang out with that guy.
Yeah, that's why we like him, having his dog or having his chili, bowl of chili, or, you know, just getting to know his idiosyncrasies. It's because you get this chance to spend some time with him. And even his car, great car that you mentioned as well.
Yeah, that the Peugeot, which that was, he picked that one out off the Universal lot. And he and Levinson and Link, when they were planning the show, had many, many disagreements and arguments. And they're like, well, let's let him pick the car. I mean, you know, that's something we don't have. Let's save our ammunition for another day. And so they're going like, well, what about this one? Well, what about this one? Well, what do you drive this? And he sees that one at the far end and that's the car. And they're like, you've got to be kidding. This little French thing, what? You know, why would a Los Angeles homicide detective be driving that? You know, and it's a very rare car. And he just thought it was another cool little thing that would be very Columbo-ish. And in fact, he was right. The dog, this car, the raincoat, the car, you know, all these things that anybody could see a picture of them and your first thought would be Columbo.
Yeah. And you mentioned Los Angeles there. I mean, it's a very specific Los Angeles. I mean, like, it's more a Chandler-esque Los Angeles than it is a 1960s, 1970s Los Angeles, right?
Yeah. And it's kind of they wanted it sort of be like a Technicolor Los Angeles, not your typical grimy, dirty surroundings, you know, dark, shadowy that you would see in a mystery show. And in fact, the first director of photography they hired, Russell Meddy, for the first five shows was an extremely well-known, accomplished, award-winning cinematographer. He'd done Spartacus and Bringing a Baby and worked with Kubrick. And, you know, he was this, a long list of credits, and he insisted on lighting it dark. Like, you know, I work with Orson Welles. This is the way you light a mystery. And they're like, no, it's not that kind of mystery. It's, you know, it's this, not happy, but they wanted this lighter, almost pastel look to it, which is for whatever reason, they thought would play best in the show. And they eventually had to bribe him with a box of Havana cigars before he'd agree to light the show they wanted to. But yeah, the play was originally set in New York, and it was the idea of Universal that no, let's change this to Los Angeles, and it'll be this sort of lighter, brighter atmosphere, and a lot easier to shoot, because then we can go all over to these mansions, you know, which a little harder to access in New York. But there's there's Beverly Hills there, and there's Bel Air there, you know, that could keep us plenty of stately homes and scenes of the crime.
I mean, that's what also makes it strange that he's this Los Angeles homicide detective, because I've been to Los Angeles, right? And I've never wanted to wear a raincoat and a suit. You know, I mean, it's just not the climate. I mean, he does look more like a New York detective who just hasn't got the memo about what the climate is like.
That's exactly right. And I think that's, again, another reason why it plays so well is, you know, everything about him, the from the raincoat to the car and so on, is the opposite of what you'd expect in his surroundings.
Yeah. And you made the reference earlier to the fact that this is sort of like a high level. Everybody, all the murderers are kind of rich and frequently, with some exceptions, kind of obnoxious as well, so that you can sort of glory in their downfall.
Yeah, and that was the idea. And in fact, they actually had to make two pilots, and in the second pilot, they had a somewhat sympathetic killer, and they didn't think that played as well. Their first female. And so they made a vow from now on, we have to hate all our murderers. And that rule didn't last long, a couple of seasons. But they just thought that that was more effective, to have somebody you could root against while you were having somebody you could root for. That it was much more satisfying that when they were brought down from their pedestal.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And there's just so many great ones. You have Roddy McDowall in one of the early ones, I remember, and Martin Sheen's in one, and you've got all these. They're not necessarily, it's Martin Sheen, maybe not the murderer, but it's the...
Right, he's the victim.
He's the victim, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's Martin Sheen before he's famous. I mean, that's the other thing, is because you've got lots of people who are sort of famous now, but weren't particularly famous. Spielberg is exactly that. But then you've also got people like Vincent Price, and I mean, one of the people you mentioned who I don't think actually ended up but was on their wish list was Orson Welles, right?
Right, yeah. And that was going to be for a episode in which the magician is the killer. The part ended up going to Jack Cassidy, who was willing to do the job for half the price that Orson Welles wanted. But Orson Welles was an accomplished amateur magician, so that seemed like a natural thought to have him. So he was the top of the list to do that show, and that unfortunately never happened, but Jack Cassidy filled in ably.
Yeah, he would have been brilliant, though, that Orson Welles. He could command a scene.
Yes. It would have been great to see them play off of each other.
Right, exactly, as well. Two actors who, weirdly, I think would have gone well together, because they're both kind of instinctive and kind of big,
Yeah, and that was, in fact, the actor who most enjoyed seemingly working with Peter Falk was Robert Culp, who just loved to work the same way Peter Falk did, which was to take a line and then let's try that with a couple different words, instead of that. Okay, let's try that with different inflections. Let's play, I'm going to throw you a line and you're not going to quite be ready for it. And they both loved working like that. And so they ended up working together four times. And it was just, it clicked so well.
Were there any co-stars that he really didn't get on well with, or there was a bust up?
Yeah, there were. Mostly he realized he was the head of the house. And these were his guests, the guest stars were coming into his house, so that he, wanted to make sure they had a good experience. It was a reflection on him. So it's not like he invited folks onto his show and then gave them a hard time.
Mm.
But there were stars over the years who sort of chafed against the way he worked, who didn't exactly, sync with that method of working. They wanted to learn their lines, deliver them as written, and move on to their next job. And he wanted to play with them and milk them and toy them and experiment. And so there were some, I know in the first season, he did a show with Eddie Albert and Suzanne Plachette, who were really looking. Suzanne Plachette was a personal friend of his, and Eddie Albert was somebody who'd heard of, had never had a chance to work with Peter Falk, and it was really looking forward to that. And then it became such a difficult experience that by the end, they're like, never doing that again. that was not my cup of tea. And then there were others that like Dick Van Dyke, who had a good experience and they were friendly with him, but they just didn't, just the dynamics of it was not there, not the way they like to work.
Right. It just didn't click. And you said earlier that, Peter Falk is a really nice guy, and you really get the feeling from this book, you really get the feeling of his personality and his warmth. But as he becomes more famous, as the series go on, he sort of, his demands get a little bit more, and he has this brinkmanship before signing for the new season of kind of like always pressuring the studio and the TV company that he might be leaving. This might be his last one. He might not come back. And that kind of ends up being sort of damaging to the series as it goes forward, right?
It does. And part of that was, that's a great term, greatmanship. I wish I would have included that in the book, because that describes it perfectly. Is he wanted, his main desire was to make the show as great as possible. And he knew he had captured lightning in a bottle, and he wanted to ride that, you know, as he thought, first of all, he should be compensated. He's got one of the top shows on television, and he only did, you know, a half dozen episodes a year. He really should be highly compensated for that. And Universal was like, well, you're just a television show, you know, and you're just one of the actors, and you're, you know, that's, you know, they didn't understand, or at least were not willing to compensate him for his value to it. And as well, they were making television shows, of which they made 30 series a year. So they were cranking them out. And, you know, if you're not going to work cheap and fast, I'll find somebody else who is. And that's not the way Peter Falk wanted to do it. So it was just this constant fight over part money, but primarily over control and what type of show it would be. And Peter Falk, to his praise and detriment, you know, was always fighting for better writers and directors and co-stars. And he didn't always have the best judgment. You know, a lot of his work with, they brought Elaine May into work on two of the shows, who's a tremendously talented director and writer and has done brilliant work. Her work on Columbo was not among those, you know, the high points of her career. It's just not something that was well suited to her talents. But he figured, oh, she's brilliant. I trust her with anything. She could do a great job. He bribed her with lots of money. And, you know, those are two of the weaker episodes, the ones she worked on. So it's good and bad. And at a certain point, Peter sort of priced himself out of the market and made people... He drove them so crazy that they were like, okay, that's it. We're done. And he, you know, who was constantly threatening to quit for 7 years, when they finally cut the cord, he was like, wait, what? You say this, what? You know, he thought it was just part of their normal tug of war, and that he'd keep doing Columbo. He'd make a Columbo or two or three every year for the rest of his life. And when it finally stopped, and ended up starting again 10 years later, but when it finally stopped, he was just completely floored and shocked. He didn't think, you know, this is NBC has two hit shows. We're one of them. So it was a shock to him when NBC let Columbo lapse.
Yeah. And I mean, it's that as we're going on, I think I'm on season four at the moment. So I haven't got into the later Columbos, and I don't have much memory of them. The ones that I'm watching sort of are very, very familiar. So I don't have much memory of him as a sort of old Columbo. Is there any point at which it sort of jumps a shark, or is the fact that they cut the cord sort of prevents that from happening?
Well, I guess that would be personal preference. You could tell in the later that made the show for seven seasons, then NBC was done. And so it sat for 10 years, and then ABC brought the show back, originally six episodes a year. And then it ended up being, you know, one or two episodes every year or two or three, you know, just sort of specials. And those first 7 years were just brilliant all the way through. You can tell there's a clunker every so often. And as the seven seasons went on, you know, the clunkers became a little more frequent. But then when they brought the show back, the clunkers became a lot more frequent. And so jump the shark, I don't know. Some people would argue that if your reason for watching Columbo is I want the best made, sharpest written, brilliant story ever, that one's good. That one I reject, and there was a lot of rejects at the end. But if you were somebody like me who was just happy to have more Columbo, you know, any day with Columbo is a good day. I'm just thankful for all the episodes that we're lucky enough to get, even if some of them aren't as good as some of the high points.
I mean, it's, in some ways, it's sort of like the fact that they're only doing, say, 6 or 7 episodes per year, and the episodes are sort of tend to be over an hour and a half long. So it always struck me as a sort of, this is like a, these are like movies, you know, that, I mean, I know there's a lot of sort of slightly snobby ways of talking about television sometimes, where people say, oh, it's not a 10 episode TV show, it's a 10 chapter movie, you know. I think that's yeah, come on, it's a TV show, fine. But with Columbo, it did kind of feel like you were watching a mini movie, so to speak.
Yeah, and that was as I think I alluded to earlier, that was the directive, is that Peter Falk really didn't want to do a television show. When he agreed to do the pilot, they viewed Prescription Murder as a true pilot, and if it was, if it took off, it would become a series, and if it didn't, it was just a one shot. And Peter Falk viewed it not as a pilot. He viewed it as a television movie, this big budget television spectacular that I'd do once and then I'd never do again. And it took a series of circumstances, including the fact that it would be like he was making 6 movies a year rather than a weekly television show, for him to agree to do it. And the budget was almost, in the beginning, was almost $500,000 per episode, which was huge at the time. And the quality of directors, and as you said, co-stars with, I mean, that one episode with Martin Sheen, the killer was Vera Miles, and there was a Vincent Price. And I mean, that was just one episode. You had three, you know, name huge movie stars all at once. And that was every week all the way through. So it was a big event.
And in your book as well, you talk about how the music and the set design, you sort of have separate sort of mini chapters on those as well. And I was really intrigued by the music when you pointed out, and it's something that never occurred to me, that Columbo doesn't really have a theme tune. It's not like, you know, the theme from Columbo isn't, you know, I couldn't whistle one, put it that way.
Yeah, well, part of the reason for that is that it was part of what they called a wheel, which was several shows on that rotated in that time zone. So the wheel, the NBC mystery movie or Wednesday night or Sunday night mystery movie, had its own Henry Mancini theme, but not each particular program. So that was one reason. The other reason was the composers didn't think, you know, they thought he was sort of a theme unto himself, you know, that he would provide the music. And in fact, in later years, he actually would, where Peter Falk latched onto this song, This Old Man. And he thought it was such a good match to the character that he started, not in the script, this was 100% him in some of the episodes starting in season 3, where he just suddenly just start whistling or humming This Old Man just because he felt like it, and they left it in. And after a couple of years of doing that, they started writing in, they knew, the writers knew Peter Falk liked the tune, and they'd start writing it in. And that sort of became sort of his unofficial theme song, even though it was, you know, originated off the cuff by Peter.
Yeah, I mean, that, which matches so much of the show and so much of the iconography around the show that he puts together. What led you to write the book? I mean, I can understand, you know, love of something, but you know, writing a book's a solid commitment. And so, how did you get there?
Well, this is my 8th book, and all my books are about topics that I want to read a book about. Right. I've always wanted to read a book about, you know, my first book was about behind the scenes at Disneyland and all everything that goes on backstage. And at the time there was no book. Now there's 50 of them, but at the time there was no book like that. And I'm like, somebody should write this book. It doesn't exist. And so that led me to several years of research and interviews to write it. And every single book I've written, I would have preferred somebody else wrote it and went to the trouble, spent the many years of research and interviews. And then I could just send over my $20 to Amazon and enjoy the fruits of their labor. And I always wanted to know what went on behind the scenes of the making of Columbo. I knew there had to be great stories. Where did these ideas for the clues and the mysteries come from? What was Peter Falk like to work with? And that's where shooting Columbo came from. There was one other earlier book called The Columbo File that was good, but you could tell in reading it, oh, there's a lot more going on behind the scenes that the author's not sharing. What is it? What, you know, what was it really like back there? And that's what led me to the book, was intense curiosity about knowing the truth about the making of this great favorite show.
I think it's so fascinating as well when you have something which is almost like the furniture in your mind. You know, it's like something I've always lived with Columbo, like I've always lived with the Beverly Hillbillies or something like that. Yeah. And so to just sort of suddenly stop for a moment and pay attention to it and go, wait a minute, how odd is that show? You know, and how strange is it that that has such a lifespan as well, you know?
Yeah, agreed. And that was the reason behind it.
Do you think, what do you look at in terms of its legacy? Is it something which just exists on its own, or do you look at other things that came afterwards, or even, you know, later on at the same time, and think that wouldn't have happened if Columbo hadn't happened?
Well, it certainly spawned a number of not quite copycats, but was sort of quirky detectives,
right?
You know, Cannon and Banachek and the probably the most successful, well-known example in the early days was Kojak, which was intentionally devised to be the flip side of Columbo. Columbo is sloppy and got all this scraggly hair, and he's, you know, sucking a cigar, and our guy will be clean shaven and, you know, obsessed with cleanliness, and he'll be sucking a lollipop, and he'll be, you know, underplayed and he'll be overplayed. And many other of those sort of interesting, the Rockford Files, you know, unique detective characters. So it started that and continues with, you know, it was direct ancestor of Monk. And I'm sure many other shows that survive today. But that, I think, is the most direct line I can draw.
Coincidentally, I got an email from Tony Shalhoub today. I could say no more, but that's an interesting.
All right. Well, I look forward to your next show.
No, I wish. I don't think he's going to come on. But I just love Tony Shalhoub. I love him in Barton Fink. He has one of the best lines of any movie ever, where he says, he tells Barton Fink, if he wants to talk to someone about writing movies, you know, he wants to meet a writer, throw a rock in here and you'll hit one. And then he stops and turns around and goes, throw it hard, Fink, throw it hard. And that's my... And you're based in California, right?
I am. I'm in California. Exactly. Not far from Los Angeles in the mansions.
Right. So have you gone on your sort of location visits of various?
Oh yeah. A lot of the mansions from Columbo are still around. And right before the book came out, I went through Los Angeles and Malibu, Bel Air, Beverly Hills, and Pasadena, and taking photographs. And then today I'm going down to Newport Beach to the scene of a couple of the shows and to plan a special event. So it's nice to see that quite a few of them are still around.
How is Columbo fandom? Because I imagine there must be a fairly dedicated cadre of fans.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's by the millions. The book has not come out that long ago, and it's already sold many copies. I've received so many messages of support of people who've been waiting for a behind the scenes book like this. The social media community is huge. It was Columbo was on a gazillion different stations and streaming platforms up until recently, when NBC, the owners or Universal, has tried to consolidate it primarily onto their own platforms, but yeah, it's still extremely popular, and which makes me very happy.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a. I mean, there was an idea in the years that Columbo was being filmed, you know, 1970s, 60s, 70s, that you have like. I remember the BBC were using the original film of their programs and reusing them, just like taping over you know, historic programs. There are so many things that were lost, maybe a bit earlier, maybe 50s and 60s, this was more. But it is remarkable that there's so much from those years that we do revisit that has that quality.
Yes, and hopefully this will be around forever, and my great grandchildren will be enjoying Columbo one day.
What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode, probably the two I enjoy the most are the Donald Pleasance episode, Any Old Port in a Storm. I just love the dynamic between the two, and the Jack Cassidy magician episode, Now You See Him, which is just just over the top fun. Those are my two favorites.
Right. I mean, it's there's so much to love in Columbo, because you do have Peter Falk and you do have the thriller aspect, but of course, you do also have a lot of comedy in there.
Yes, yeah, and most of it flows out of his personality. Quite a few. They would start writing more comedy in as the seasons progressed, once they knew what they had to play with. But in the early seasons, in particular, just so much of that is off the cuff. From Peter, just Peter being Peter, and going off on tangents and detours of things that weren't on the script to draw personality out of.
I love that there's an episode where he goes to the tailor to have a suit made, and because it's a clue he's trying to look up. It's not, you know, but his conversation with the tailor is just like a comedy skit. It's just he has to have it for Saturday because he's going with his wife to the Legion for a dinner, and they're going to have bingo and stuff like that. And it's just absolutely beautifully played. And the guy who plays the tailor is just absolutely wonderful as well. I just have one last question.
One more thing.
Yeah, one more thing. Ah, damn it! I ruined my line.
Cut that back.
Rewind. David. One more thing. Yeah. we're recommending film books throughout this podcast series. So, have you got a favorite film book or film books that you would like to recommend to our listeners?
I do. My favorite book is one I've read over and over again, and it's part because it's about my favorite film stars, but also part because it's just so fun to read. And to me, if you're writing a book about, say, horror movies, that book should be a little scary. And if you're writing about comedians, it should be a funny, fun book. And this is. It's a book about the Marx Brothers. It's called... Groucho, Harpo, Chico, and Sometimes Zeppo by Joe Adamson, which is one of the first film books I read when I was young. And it's just, if you like the Marx Brothers, it's just fun all the way through while incorporating a huge amount of behind the scenes information, and one that got me started along the way of being interested in taking films and televisions, programs and theme parks, and looking behind the scenes and telling their story that people didn't know before.
Yeah, I've got to look up your Disneyland book, because that sounds really fascinating as a subject as well.
And it is.
I've been to Disneyland. I went to Disneyland, and I was we went with our kids, and I was kind of reluctant. It was some friends who were saying, "No, you've got to go. You've got to go." And I was like, "Oh, I'll bring a book. You know, I'm not going to really enjoy this." Mm. And then, you know, midnight was there, and I was like, "No, I don't want to go home. I want to have another go. They're closing now. You have to go home." So
yes.
wonderful. Well, thank you so much, David. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about a subject. And this book, I'm not surprised that it's doing really well, because in the fan community, because I think there are a lot of fans out there, and there are a lot of people. Do you think there was one time somebody did a little mock-up of, I think it was Mark Ruffalo, from a shot from the Zodiac Killer film. So he was in his 70s garb in a 70s style car, and they just put the Columbo sort of title under. And I was just thinking, oh God, yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing Mark Ruffalo sort of do a Columbo, or an Oscar Isaac do a Columbo. You know, there's a few actors, Michael Shannon, he'd make a good Columbo. Is there anyone who you think they could bring the character back, or is it too, it has to be Peter Falk, so just forget about it, go and do something new?
Yeah, well, it will be difficult because it's like, how much do you read? Do you try to do a caricature of Peter Falk, and how much do you make it original? And both of those options are probably no win. It's a very difficult thing to pull off because you'll always be compared to what you're trying to do or what you purposely avoided doing. So it would be certainly not impossible. And it's something I know will come one day universal for many years, and continuing to this day is working on ideas on how to bring the show back, how to reboot it somehow, and what direction, how do we change it up and make it relevant and yet still tied to, so it's still Columbo. It's going through a lot of litigation with the estate of Levinson and Lake right now. So I think that must be resolved before a reboot ever comes. But eventually, I mean, everything else has been remade. Eventually it will be. Yeah. And I look forward to the arguments that will flow through.
The discourse. I mean, we've had Magnum and we've had Hawaii Five-O, and we've had, we've had a load of those. And I don't think any of them have been particularly successful. I mean, I might be mistaken. They might have all,
Yeah.
But it's hard to think of any that have sort of equaled or surpassed the original.
Right.
Brilliant, David. Thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, John. Take care.
So that was my conversation with David Koenig, the author of Shooting Columbo. It was a brilliant, I enjoyed it. It was a great conversation, I thought. It gave me an opportunity to talk a lot about and find out a lot about one of my favorite TV characters, certainly one of my favorite TV detectives. His recommended book was Groucho, Harpo, Chico, and Sometimes Zeppo, A History of the Marx Brothers by Joe Adamson. I'm going to put that on my reading list. We haven't had that one. That's not been recommended before. So apologies for having a little bit of a uneven sort of schedule in terms of putting episodes out. This has been because, as you will already know from previous podcasts, that was because of a very hectic festival season, which went Locarno, Sarajevo, and Venice one after the other in close proximity. Hopefully things are going to be getting back to normal now. We've got some guests lined up. I've got some guests lined up, and I'll be putting out episodes on at the usual time on a weekly basis. But it's been a lot of fun, and I will also be putting out a live episode from Venice, which I just need to put together in time as an episode. So I'm going to put that out a little bit later on this month. Hopefully you're enjoying the podcasts. Hopefully if you've been missing them, you've been going back and listening to some of the older ones. That's always a good fun thing to do. If you have any suggestions for guests, by the way, by all means, send me an email. It's drjohnty@gmail.com, but it's drjohnty. So it's a little bit different from my Twitter handle. All that's left is for me to thank Elliot Atkins for the music and Ali Harwood for the art. And thank you, dear listeners, for listening to Writers on Film.
It's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.